Yemeni army says it's launched a drone and ballistic missile attack on Aramco facilities in eastern Saudi Arabia. More than 100 NGOs and human rights groups calling for an arms embargo on Israel over its violation of international humanitarian law in Palestinian territories. Head of Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council, Sheikh Abdul Amir Gavlan, passes away at the age of 85. I'm Behrou Zajafi. Welcome. Now let's begin with Yemen. The army there saying it's carried out fresh retaliatory attacks against Saudi positions in the kingdom's east. The army spokesman says that the raids were performed using drones and ballistic missiles. General Yahya Sariya said the targets were the Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura, as well as other locations including Jeddah on the Red Sea coast. Saudi officials had said earlier that they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks were in response to years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen. The Saudi-led war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions more since 2015. Activist and political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says that the latest Yemeni attacks indicate that peace talks with Saudi Arabia seem to have not yielded any positive results.
To focus on those oil facility, I think that Yemeni forces can bring down Saudi to its knee. And as well, they have target Aramco facility in Najran and Jizan and in Jeddah. This means that it is clear message that the Yemeni ballistic drone unit and ballistic Yemeni drone unit and ballistic missile unit can actually cover all Saudi Arabia from Dammam to Jeddah to Najran to Jizan to Asir. And in this latest statement from Al Amid Sari', he has not actually mentioned what type of military site Yemeni army has conducted attack on. He only mentioned the economic side, and I think that this Saudi Arabia should learn that when Yemeni army actually in the last 3 months they have conducted only a few small attack on Abha airport, they were just trying to give time if there is any peace, if the Omani negotiation and Omani will help to bring Yemeni side and Saudi side to talk to the table. But this actually shows that when Yemeni army conduct this major and huge attack, this actually explains clearly that there is no any good coming from this talk and the negotiation led by Oman.
Head of Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council, Sheikh Abdul Amir Gavlan, has passed away. He was a prominent cleric who was also instrumental in the political arena.
Sheikh Abdul Amir Gavlan, the head of Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council, has died at the age of 85. He had been hospitalized in recent days following his deteriorating health conditions. He was born in 1936 in one of the villages of Jabal Amil, a region distinguished by its religious seminaries and populated by one of the world's oldest Shia communities. He had a key role in the scientific and political movement in Jabal Amil. When young, he took up religious studies at the seminary in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf. While in Iraq, he was persecuted by the former Baghdad regime of Saddam Hussein. Sheikh Gavlan continued his religious education later on in Damascus and elsewhere, and was educated by some of the top religious figures of the time. In 1994, Sheikh Mohammad Mahdi Shamsuddin was elected president of Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council, and Sheikh Gavlan was unanimously elected vice president. In 2000, Sheikh Gavlan assumed presidency of the council. He had a close relationship with senior Lebanese cleric Imam Musa Sadr, who founded the Supreme Islamic Shia Council in 1969. Sheikh Gavlan was a staunch advocate of resistance against the Israeli regime. He stressed that any agreement to normalize relations with Tel Aviv is religiously forbidden and would pave the way for the so-called Deal of the Century initiative proposed by the U.S. and aimed at dealing a blow to the issue of Palestine. He had called on Arab nations to neutralize any such deals and underlined the need to boycott Israeli goods. He was an influential figure in Lebanon's religious and political arenas during his lifetime.
It's not news review time. Do stick around. 120 international NGOs and rights groups have signed a petition demanding state parties to the arms trade treaty to impose a comprehensive embargo on all weapons trade with Israel. The NGOs say that countries have a legal and moral obligation to end the regime's use of arms for committing serious violations of international humanitarian law and human rights against Palestinian civilians. They say that governments and companies that continue to sell arms to Israel are complicit in the regime's systematic brutality, its war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And this against the backdrop of Israel's deadly war that killed nearly 250 Palestinians in Gaza. Back in May, Israel also conducted a deadly crackdown on Al-Quds protests against the Israelis' illegal seizure of Palestinian land this spring. Okay, now time now to invite a couple of guests and see what they think about this story, and let's get some insight. So I'll be joined by Feroz Miti Borwala, National General Secretary of the India-Palestine Solidarity Forum in Mumbai, and also Edward Cargan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Turning to Mumbai first, Feroz, I told you about the petition. 120 NGOs, they're all calling for this. So how far will this petition hopefully go?
I think it's about creating public opinion. But it's going to take a long, long time for governments and especially the big Lockheed Martins and the Raytheons to come out with a weapons ban on Israel. But every bit of the movement over the last decades have helped to build public opinion across the world against Israel. It has helped build public opinion within America, very crucial to build that, where a number of liberal Jews, increasingly the younger generation of Jews, is coming out actively. We have now Arab Americans who are out on the streets, who are leading the movement within America. So the movements are making a big difference. And for 122 organizations from the world over to come out with this joint statement, is very, very important, and the movement will carry on.
Okay. Now, let me turn to London, Ontario. Edward, you're a lawyer. So if somebody asks you about the type of crimes and maybe the number of crimes that the Tel Aviv regime has committed against the Palestinians, I imagine you would come up with a long, long list.
Well, the incidents would number in the thousands, and of course there's many invasions of and attacks on Gaza, invasions of Lebanon, attacks on Jordan, and almost daily missile attacks on Syria, and of course violation of Lebanese airspace. But these are moral arguments, but they don't, and they have the weight of law, and they're well grounded in international law. But there is no army or no force or political force that is going to force the Americans, the British, the French, and other countries who supply arms to Israel, including India, actually, and also about who buy Israeli arms and help subsidize the Israeli military industrial complex. So the statement is very eloquent, very forceful, perfectly true, but the Muslim world, the Arab world, other countries have to step up their game and actually affect and punish these companies that sell weapons to Israel, and also attack Israel where it hurts in their economic situation, not just embarrassing, sending them emails or letters or making statements. Mm-hmm. There have been hundreds of these statements presented over the years, signed by many people, but they're not signed by institutions that have power. Thankfully, there is a good representation from, you know, liberal Jews and Jewish anti-Zionists, the Jewish Voice for Peace, Canadian Jew, independent Jewish voice, and, you know, even in Israel, the international, or the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolition has signed this petition as well. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, all of, and various Christian groups, and of course Muslim groups, but, you know, the pro-Palestinian side, in order to affect the Israelis, has to hit them where it hurts, economically, politically, and, you know, embarrassing them is a start, but with the control and lack of interest of the corporate press in North America, and to a lesser extent in Europe, these messages, you know, never see the light of day and never have a chance to, you know, increase and support for the Palestinians and the general public. Thankfully, the Israelis have done so many terrible things, and there is a, you know, major shift in opinion within the Democratic Party, and especially within the American Jewish community, and in the younger Jews in particular. You know, a significant portion of them no longer support Israel, and even consider Israel being an apartheid state that is committing genocide against the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But we have to make the transition to a more effective, a more powerful campaign that will actually have a real impact on these corporations that sell arms and also on Israeli policy.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. Farooz Mithy Barwala with National General Secretary of the India-Palestine Solidarity Forum joined us from Mumbai, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And that's it for this news review. Let's move on with the another item that we have. We have in Iraq people holding a funeral for senior Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim.
يا فاطمة يا أمير المؤمنين المرتضى.
Mourners converged in the holy city of Najaf on Sunday to bid farewell to the eminent religious figure. He will be laid to rest in that city. A similar procession was held in Karbala on Saturday. The top cleric passed away at the age of 87. He was among four prominent religious figures in Iraq and taught at the religious seminary of Najaf alongside top cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. At least 16 security personnel have been killed in separate attacks in the Iraqi cities of Kirkuk and Mosul. Security sources saying that 13 policemen were killed and three others got wounded during a two-hour firefight with assailants who attacked a checkpoint in Kirkuk after midnight Sunday. The sources blamed the incident on Daesh terrorists. Separately, at least three soldiers were killed and another one was wounded when a gunman attacked a checkpoint southeast of Mosul. Iraq has seen sporadic terrorist attacks since the country announced victory over Daesh in 2017. Iran's Covfars vaccine has entered the third human trial stage. The recombinant vaccine will be the third Iranian-made jab that has reached this phase. Yusuf Jalal reports.
Among the seven Iranian COVID vaccines, Covfars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in two groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other the Razi Covfars. We are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Covfars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Cove Parks will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Cove Parks is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Cove Parks says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months.
As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Cove Parks developers say they've already lost their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Al Borz Province.
All right, now time now to cast a look at Afghanistan. Heavy clashes raging in Panjshir province, where the Taliban are trying to take out the last pockets of resistance against their takeover over the country last month. The Taliban saying they've advanced deep into Panjshir Valley north of Kabul. Spokesman says that the advancing forces have captured four of the province's seven districts and are inching closer to the center. The opposition forces, however, reject the claim. They say they have confronted the Taliban. The National Resistance Front of Afghanistan, led by local leader Ahmad Massoud, says it has surrounded thousands of Taliban forces. On a Facebook post, Massoud insists that Panjshir will continue to stand strong. Our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, joined us earlier with the latest on the situation in Panjshir Valley. Let's listen to him.
Fightings are underway between the Northern Resistance Front and the Taliban, who have surrounded the entire Panjshir province and northeast of Kabul. Panjshir province has at least seven districts, and the Taliban are claiming that we have captured four out of these seven districts of key province in northern Afghanistan. But according to Fahim Dashti, who is one of the spokespersons of Northern Resistance Front, that is led by Ahmed Massoud, who himself is the son of the legendary Afghan commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, says that the Northern Resistance Front has captured alive nearly 1,000 Taliban fighters who had entered Panjshir province via a very strategic pass from Baghlan province.
That's right for this news broadcast from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. There is perhaps no doubt that the transnational criminal syndicates and networks undermine the stability and security of all nations through their illicit enterprises, including the transshipment of drugs, arms, illegal contraband, trafficked women and children, laundered money, financial fraud, counterfeiting, and cybercrime. In the first part of the documentary, we saw that behind the supply of illicit goods and services is often a web of international organized crime. The interwoven strands of such illicit and criminal transactions make it almost impossible to separate one from the other. International criminals have tremendous financial resources and spare no expense to corrupt government and law enforcement officials. They also have extensive worldwide networks to support their operations and are inherently nimble, adapting quickly to change. Stay with us as we further investigate these issues in the second part of the documentary.
Villas and castles, luxury hotels, real estate, bank accounts. The range of riches seized each year by the Italian justice system makes one dizzy. In 2010, it was over 9 billion euros, nearly 5 billion in 2011. It gives some idea of the financial clout of organized crime. And this is just in Italy. Money laundering is at the heart of the mafia infiltration. On Rome's Via Vivento, the Café de Paris is a showpiece. Photos of Mastroianni or Fellini decorate the walls. But now the ghost of the 'Ndrangheta boss haunts it. After months of investigation, Italian investigators discovered that this cult symbol of the Dolce Vita belonged, in fact, to Calabrian clan boss Vincenzo Alvaro. Alvaro had organized his business through many shell companies run by men of straw. Another type of laundering circuit is the Japanese ants. The Japanese mafioso gives some false tourists, the ants, a sum of dirty money and air tickets to Paris. The ants buy luxury items, leather goods, perfumes, haute couture. Back in Japan, the ants hand them to the trafficker and receive a small commission. The luxury goods go into the window of a boutique. Paris luxury goods, owned by the mafia. When they're sold, the circle is complete. Money laundering became more sophisticated in the 1980s. Franklin Giraudo was one of the architects of this new era. Financier of the Cartel of Cali, after studies at Harvard, Giraudo set up a circuit that still works today. Drug traffickers were amassing huge fortunes thanks to drugs. Giraudo split the process into two phases. It's simple, but you need to listen carefully. Let's say I'm a Colombian drug dealer. I travel to a Caribbean tax haven and deposit my suitcases of cash in a bank account. No one's the wiser. My dirty money is then transferred to another bank, in Germany perhaps, into the account of a front man. Now it begins to branch out. The money is transferred and circulates between dozens of ever more respectable banks. Across dozens or hundreds of bank accounts, in Monaco, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, or Austria, to avoid drawing attention to the banking authorities, the transfers are never over $10,000. For the second phase of the Giraudo cycle, I need to get the money back to Colombia. Through Men of Straw, I set up European companies. These will invest the laundered money in my name in restaurants and property in Colombia, quite legally. Dispersion, concealment, and globalization become the keys to criminal finance. It's hardly surprising that Jurado's scheme began in the 80s. Under the influence of Thatcher and Reagan, a new ideology was preaching deregulation as the sine qua non of economic policies. Shady capitalism takes root. Finance becomes queen. It was a gift for people wanting to recycle dirty money. Criminal money swims like a fish in deregulated financial waters, following the currents used by money from political corruption and tax evasion. Currents that take it to places smelling of holidays and dirty money. The Cayman Islands and the Virgin Islands, Panama. But not just them. There are about 50 tax havens around the world where the money circulates nonstop. The spider's web of the illegal economy. John Christensen is a leader in the fight against tax havens. He knows them well. He was economic advisor to the government of Jersey for 11 years.
When I was working offshore in Jersey, in the finance world, the fees that I charged were much higher than anything one would charge working in normal, legitimate activity, because they're expecting higher fees, because they want you to work on their side. What they're paying you for is what the Swiss call discretion, what I would call secrecy. In other words, you are not going to cooperate with investigators. You are going to put every single barrier in the way of investigation. At one stage, I was investigating on behalf of a client, a gigantic petrol company. I was investigating one Russian company that was thinking about doing a joint venture. And this company was set up with structures in Jersey, in Cyprus, in Switzerland, in Delaware, in the Netherlands, across a whole range of different tax havens. Nobody knew who owned that company. Nobody at all. We suspected, and we involved Russian intelligence in our investigations, we suspected that it belonged to the very highest levels politically in Russia at that time, the very highest levels, but we could never get the evidence. The evidence was in fact kept in a safe in a law office in Cyprus.
In Cyprus, Jersey and Monaco, at these counters of the black economy, silence is well rewarded. And nobody's complaining.
It corrupts the lawyers and the bankers and so on, because they are effectively colluding with criminals, and they know they're colluding with criminals, but the money's far too seductive to turn down.
In the secret world of international finance, nothing looks as clean as dirty money. The biggest money laundering centers are some of the most select towns in Europe. Tranquil, Switzerland, for example. 30 kilometers of Zurich, the canton of Zug, is one of the flagships of financial obscurity. Over the years, the transnationals have set up their headquarters in Zug. Extrata Glencore, or Transocean, leader in oil drilling, involved in the pollution of the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Where is the criminal money in all this? In this faceless world of illegal capitalism, it's impossible to identify it. So fraud or blindness? There is another financial center that perfectly illustrates this outlaw capitalism where everything gets mixed up. It may be the atomic heart of a system out of control. London and its sacred enclave, the City of London, leading deregulation since the 1980s. All the players and tools of criminal finance are here, using all the methods of the classic hoodlums.
London is very attractive for money launderers on many, many fronts. And far better educated people than me have commented that London is the number one offshore tax haven in the world. We're offshore to Europe. We're having some interesting dialogue with Europe at the moment in relation to our financial services status. But we're also offshore to the rest of the world. And our Commonwealth heritage with the Cayman Islands, with the British Virgin Islands, with Belize and many other offshore jurisdictions gives us quite a strong position.
If you look at many of these small islands, they have a shared characteristic, and that characteristic is their stamps carry the head of Britain's Queen there on the stamp. They fly the Union flag, and this isn't an accident. This has been part of the City of London's development strategy.
London, hub of the world's financial movements, whatever the color of the money.
If you can push your money into and take your money out of London, you once again have this appearance of legitimacy. If the money has been good enough for London, then it's good enough for anyone.
The international community has been fighting money laundering since the 1990s. An intergovernmental organization, the FAFT, has made a list of recommendations. Their calls for transparency have been quite ineffectual. The mafias aren't affected by the economic crisis. In fact, the current financial depression may well be a fabulous opportunity to consolidate their position. Faced with this major challenge of our time, our leaders seem to be either blind or resigned, or something more. Martin Woods has witnessed this deadly addiction. He was involved in the greatest money laundering scandal ever. In 2005, this ex-Scotland Yard man was engaged by the London branch of a big American bank, Wachovia. Woods soon identified clients linked to Casas de Cambio, the Mexican Money Exchange Bureau.
What we saw were large batches of travelers' checks, sequentially numbered, bearing illegible signatures, no dates, and critically, no identification features upon the rear of any of the checks to enable me to ascertain who it was who presented the checks. Back to basics, who was the customer? We couldn't see that.
Martin Woods alerted his bosses. He didn't know he was not alone. The U.S. federal authorities were also watching Wachovia, especially after the Mexican army intercepted a plane in 2006, hired by the cartel of Sinaloa. The plane was full of cocaine. The investigation showed it was bought with money passing through the Wachovia bank.
There were some bankers who were engaged in marketing this service to Casas de Cambio customers and providing banking services that were used to launder money. And when I confronted and challenged this, I was confronted, challenged, and even attacked by the bankers for my own conduct.
Despite the evidence gathered by Woods, the bank ignored this and directed all its criticisms towards him.
I didn't have support from my departmental bosses. In fact, I found no support there whatsoever. And it took the bank a long time to realize that money did not control me. Money did not influence me in the same way that it influenced them. And this was rarely emphasized when my boss telephoned me in 2009 to tell me that my bonus for 2008 was zero. That was a very defining moment.
The outcome of this exemplary story is Woods was fired. When the American justice system caught up with Wachovia in March 2010, it got off with a ridiculously low fine.
I cannot explain or understand why the Justice Department decided not to prosecute the Wachovia managers. Perhaps something is related to the crisis and the fear that after the collapse of a big bank in the US, Lehman Brothers, another big bank, Wachovia, would fail. That may be an explanation, but it may also show that the presence of mafia money is so strong that it has become irreversible and they are not even prosecuting.
In 2008, Wachovia was bought by a rival, Wells Fargo, which paid the bill, a fine of $150 million. Grotesque, when we know that in total, Wachovia laundered $378 billion, an astonishing sum, one-fifth of France's GNP.
I cannot, honestly, think of one single bank in the world that has not been touched by this problem. To an extent that some of my very militant colleagues who are concerned about all this say that it is not mafia looking for banks, it's banks looking for mafia money.
I think, you know, there were bankers who have to question themselves and perhaps should be questioned by authorities as to what they were doing. Ultimately, how close is a launderer's finger to the trigger of the killer's gun? Who knows?
On the surface, we see that the integrity of banking and financial services depends heavily on the perception that it functions within a framework of high legal, professional, and ethical standards. And a reputation for integrity is one of the most valuable assets of a financial institution. The fact is that the policy of silence prevails, and criminal finance is shaping the economic, political, and social landscape of our modern world. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.
is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود باعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program for a better life. First of all, what is a better life? The answer is when a person is happy. Now, this happiness is not the material happiness, but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. So how can I become a better person? In the very first session, we said that the first step to become a better person is yaqda, which is to wake up. Now, wake up from what? Wake up from my deep sleep of negligence. Wake up from ghafla. Ayatollah Jawadi Amli said that the solution to the problem of ghafla was two things. One, to take care of our thoughts, and two, to remember Allah constantly, to do dhikr. In the previous session, we said that when we recite the dhikr, Subhanallahi walhamdulillahi wa la ilaha illallah wallahu akbar, Allah creates four birds that will glorify Him till Qiyamah. So brothers and sisters, man sometimes, like Prophet Isa alayhi salam, can become a manifestation of Allah's attribute. Isa alayhi salam created a bird from clay with the leave of Allah. Look, just like Allah, even He created, but with the leave of Allah. And Allah talks about it in Surah Maida, verse 110. He says, وَإِذْ تَخْلُقُ مِنَ الدِّينِ كَحَيَّةِ الطَّيْرِ بِإِذْنِي فَتَنْفُقُ فِيهَا فَتَكُونُ طَيْرًا بِإِذْنِي. And when you would create from clay the form of a bird with my leave, and you would breathe into it, and it would become a bird with my leave, yani with my permission. And sometimes in the soul of the one who is doing dhikr, birds are created, and without clay, that glorify Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When one creates such a bird, he becomes a manifestation of Allah's attribute. And which attribute? The attribute of creation, the attribute of qaliqiyat. That means he becomes a creator. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said that when Prophet Yahya alayhi salam said, Ya Rabbi, Ya Allah, Allah replied, Labbaik Ya Abdi, Salhajatak, meaning, here I am, my servant, ask what you want. In regards to this, Allah said in Quran, وَحَنَانًا مِنْ لَدُنَّا, and a compassion from us. So Allah said that His compassion was descended on Yahya alayhis salam. In return, Yahya alayhis salam was compassionate too. This is what Prophet Yahya taught us. He told us, you also say Ya Allah and listen to the Labbaik from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is also narrated, brothers and sisters, that if you have a wish, recite Ya Allah 10 times and ask what you want, and Allah will answer your prayers. That means I just say 10 times, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. I say 10 times and then I ask what I want and Allah will answer my prayers. So this is how our imams taught us the way of Isa alayhi salam, where you can create those birds with your worship, and Yahya alayhi salam, who said Ya Allah, Ya Rabbi, and Allah says Labbaik. If we follow their path, then we will be blessed with divine help too. Now we'll get back after a short break.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to the program For a Better Life. And we were talking about the path of Isa alayhi salam and Yahya alayhi salam, where Isa alayhi salam created a bird with clay with the permission of Allah, and how Yahya alayhi salam used to say, Ya Allah, Ya Rabbi, Ya Allah, and Allah would say, Labbaik. And there are many traditions that say that with every drop of water that is used for wudu, an angel is created. This also displays the path of Isa alayhi salam, where he created, and now we can create with wudu. But if someone is negligent in their salat and prays negligently, then his wudu for his salat was done negligently too. However, nothing is created with such a wudu and such a salat. In fact, such a salat is an example of the verse, فَوَيْلٌ لِلْمُصَلِّينَ, woe to them who pray, الَّذِينَ هُمْ أَنْ صَلَاتِهِمْ سَاهُونَ, those are heedless of their prayers. So for this wudu, a person who does negligently, it should be said, in the same manner it should be said, فَوَيْلُ لِلْمُطَحَّرِينَ, woe to them who do the taharat, who cleanse themselves. الَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنْ taharatihim sahun, those who are heedless of their tahara, of their cleanliness, of their purification, of their wudu. Therefore, an angel is not created with the drops of such a wudu. Some might object, saying, how is it possible for a man to be a creator? Such a person has not believed in the words of the Imams. We have plenty authentic narrations from the Imams that confirm that angels are created with the worship of the wayfarer, the Salik. Unfortunately, such a person has still not believed that man with the right and correct worship, with his sahih salat and sahih wudu, with his sahih ibadah, he can also follow the path of Isa alayhi salam by creating. He does not have to be a prophet or an imam. He can do what Isa alayhi salam did and become a manifestation of Allah's attribute of creativity. For example, Shamun, who is also called Simon, he was the disciple and the successor of Isa alayhi salam. He also performed miracles of Isa alayhi salam with the leave of Allah, of course. One of the followers of Isa alayhi salam walked with him on water. And when he was walking, remember the story, it's a very famous story. What happened? He started thinking, halfway he goes and he goes like, oh, I'm also doing what Isa does. So I'm also doing what a prophet does. And he started getting proud. And right then, he started drowning. And he goes like, whoa, 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 Isa, help me. And Isa alayhi salam pulls him out and says, did you think about something that you should not be thinking? And the man repents and he says like, yes, I started feeling proud. And he repents. And then he starts walking on the water with Isa alayhi salam. So there are many more examples as such. We just have to believe in them. So if we do the right worship, like the right salat, the right wudu, when I say right, I mean without being negligent, then we can also be creator of angels. So let us pray to Allah that He gives us the tawfiq to worship Him with all our heart and soul and to become a better person. And when I become a better person, that will lead me to have a better life, insha'Allah. Wa akhiru da'wahum anilhamdu lillahi rabbil alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
It's all I need.
It's all I need.
All I need. Oh.
All I need to be all so I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.